Today we get into something heavy. I'm going to make a desperate attempt to make it simple, hoping that the boys and girls can understand it. It's the third angel and his message, and it's found in Revelation, the 14th chapter. I want to read it, even though it's very familiar to Seventh-day Adventists who have grown up in Sabbath school and Bible docs classes. You'll have to admit that it's one of the most solemn warnings ever given. Revelation 14, beginning with verse 9. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation." Right there is where I usually skip the next lines, or at least cough and sneeze and sputter through the next lines so that they can't hear them, because who needs those next lines? But we'll read them today. "And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest, day nor night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name." Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. I hope that even those hard lines will mean something today before we're finished. Now, what is the message of the third angel, and what are these three angels all about? We've noticed so far that there are few, even of those who claim to believe it, that understand what the third angel's message is. And yet this is the message for this time. In fact, we were told years ago that there is not one in 100 who understands for himself the Bible truth on this subject. And yet it is extremely important, necessary to our present and eternal welfare. Not even all of our ministers who give the third angel's message really understand what constitutes that message. That kind of instruction can keep a preacher awake at night, an Adventist preacher. Well, back before the turn of the century, there was a heavy rising emphasis on the great theme of salvation only through Jesus Christ. And it was very similar to the rising emphasis we see today. That's why it becomes even more relevant today. People got nervous. People always get nervous when salvation only through Jesus Christ is taught, because it deflates our ego and our desire to want to do it ourselves. And so some of the people began writing in letters. So many people wrote letters to a little lady by the name of Ellen White, worrying that we would become so absorbed in this thing of salvation by faith alone in Jesus Christ that we would forget about our message of warning to the world. That she chose to publish an answer to these letters in our church paper, Review and Herald. And the answer went like this. Several have written inquiring if the message of justification by faith is the third angel's message. And I have answered, it is the third angel's message in verity or in truth. In reality, that's what the message of the third angel is all about. Well, where did you get that in the lines that I just read? That's what we have to try and see this morning. If any man worship the beast in his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, this is justification by faith? Well, that's what we were told. And yet, not one in 100 understood it. Has it changed today? Last time, we noticed that there are, in the setting of the three angels, there are two themes that are extremely important for a perishing world. Number one, justification by faith. And number two, the righteousness of Christ are the themes to be presented to a perishing world. Bible Commentary 7, 964. Now, as this emphasis began to rise in the 1880s and 1890s, there was a very precise description given of the content of the message or the messages. And in order to understand how they relate to these three angels, I would like to invite you to notice the three-part description of the emphasis and the message. Number one, the time of test is just upon us, for the loud cry of the third angel has already begun in the revelation of the righteousness of Christ, the sin-pardoning Redeemer. This is the beginning of the light of the angel whose glory shall fill the whole earth. Review and Herald, 11:22-92. So the beginning of the loud cry of the third angel was the revelation of the righteousness of Christ. Well, we've already noticed that the message for a perishing world is, number one, justification by faith, number two, the righteousness of Christ. Some of us did some careful research to find out how these two phrases are used. Number one, justification by faith is always used to refer to the work of God for us on the cross and in heaven. Number two, the phrase, the righteousness of Christ, includes the work of God for us and the work of God in us. Transformation, character development, victory, and so forth. Justification by faith, the work of God for us. Righteousness by faith adds to it and includes the work of God in us. The loud cry of the third angel began with the message of the revelation of the righteousness of Christ. All right? Now, the second point of emphasis. All power is given into Jesus' hands that he may dispense rich gifts unto men, imparting the priceless gift of his own righteousness to the helpless human agent. This is the message that God commanded to be given to the world. It is the third angel's message, which is to be proclaimed with a loud voice and attended with the outpouring of his Spirit in large measure. Testimonies to Ministers 91 and 92. Then the beginning of the loud cry of the third angel is the righteousness of Christ. The content of the loud cry of the third angel is the imparting of his righteousness to the helpless human agent. The third point of emphasis, the message of Christ's righteousness is to sound from one end of the earth to the other to prepare the way of the Lord. This is the glory of God which closes the work of the third angel. So I hope you can see by this, the last one was 6T, page 19, that the beginning, the content, and the conclusion of the work of the third angel is the righteousness of Christ, which includes the work of God for us and the work of God in us. With that in mind, let's get more specific then to the ingredients of the message of the third angel. If you've studied it at all, including Revelation 13, the chapter that precedes it, you know that we have a beast, we have an image to the beast, we have a mark of the beast, and we have a name or a number of the beast. We used to have a little poodle that liked to chew on the furniture. And we still have some marks in the furniture we call the mark of the beast. But I, for some reason, whenever I think of the mark of the beast, I think of that. It's funny how those kind of things stick in your mind. But this beast is far more significant than a poodle, I'll tell you. This beast is a world-impressing beast, because it says that all the world is going to wonder after this beast. Well, what is this beast? I'm not going to go to a great deal of time and effort to prove to you who the beast is. If you are acquainted at all with the studies of Daniel and Revelation represented by this church, you already know. And it isn't based simply upon some simple little number called 666, please. If you've ever studied the lines of prophecy, you know that there are at least 10 different identifying marks from every direction that pinpoint what this beast power represents. And I'm not even going to name it, except to say this much. Last week we noticed that the warning in these three angels is a warning against self-worship. Now, by self-worship, what we mean is not bowing down in front of yourself in the bathroom mirror. It isn't adoring yourself, although there are some who have done that. I remember reading the description of the famous rock singer who died a while back and how he apparently did that. We're not talking so much about worshiping yourself in the mirror as we are talking about independence, self-sufficiency, depending upon ourselves instead of God. That's what we mean by self-worship. And if there's anything that is offensive to the Creator who made us, it is to have the creature worshiping himself instead of the Creator. And it isn't because God is somehow egocentric. It's because he knows what self-worship does to people. And it's because of his love that he wants us to worship the Creator instead of the created. People who worship themselves are miserable. Aren't we aware of that? In fact, we know, just on the basis of psychology and the study of the human mind, that the most miserable person in the world is the one whose attention is most centered on himself. We know that. And we know, without even bringing God or religion into it, that the happiest person in the world is the one whose attention is diverted from himself and is outward toward others. That is a universal and timeless principle. And so I like to think of it in those terms instead of a selfish God up there who says, here I made them and they're not worshiping me. That's not the issue. God is love and he wants our happiness. So it becomes offensive to God because he knows what it does in destroying human beings to worship themselves. They become miserable. But if there's anything worse than one person worshiping himself and depending upon himself and trusting to his own works for Christianity or eternal salvation, it's a whole group of people doing that. And if there's anything worse than that, it's an organized group of millions of people doing that. And that's why this beast power gets such bad marks in Scripture. It represents organized self-worship. And by that we mean organized dependence upon what we can do to merit salvation. That's why the beast gets bad marks in Revelation. It is the greatest system of self-worship that has ever been. All right, let's move quickly on to the next aspect of this. I'd like to talk just very briefly about the mark of the beast. Now, some of us have grown up going to closed-door lectures where you can be admitted only by ticket to public presentations of the mark of the beast. Why, the mark of the beast is one of the most fascinating topics to the religious man in the street. There are many people other than your subculture that have for a long time been interested in the mark of the beast. And there's been all kind of speculation on it. Well, what about the Seventh-day Adventist understanding of the mark of the beast and the way we have presented it? Has it been right or wrong? In our present series, we're not trying to down our historic and prophetic approach to this. We're only trying to add to it. And so in our historic and prophetic approach, has it been correct? Listen. The light that we have upon the third angel's message is the true light. The mark of the beast is exactly what it has been proclaimed to be. Not all in regard to this matter is yet understood, however. Volume 8, Testimonies 159. All right, let's try and understand a little more about it. Please, the mark of the beast includes something more than a day of worship. Now, there has been a debate concerning which is the proper day to worship on. And we are familiar with the Saturday-Sunday debate, the seventh day versus the first day of the week debate. You will find, if you study it carefully, that Sunday in Scripture and in prophecy is indicating something more than simply a day. There is something far deeper than the day. The day is a symbol of something. Sunday is a symbol of salvation by works. Sunday in history and prophecy becomes a symbol of man doing it himself. Why? Because God never changed his day of worship from Saturday to Sunday. Man did. And any man who thinks he can change what God has done is a victim of do-it-yourself, you see. And thinking to presume to change something that the eternal God, who changes not, has already done, is the height of blasphemy. So this Sunday thing becomes a symbol of doing it yourself. What man thinks he can do. Therefore, it becomes a system of works, man's works, instead of God's works. You know that the seventh day was given as an honor of God's creative power, his works of creation. And when man comes along and thinks he can change it, then you see Sunday is more than just keeping a day. It becomes a symbol of works, man's works, his dependence upon what he can do, his pride, and therefore is blasphemy. You'll also discover that Saturday, the seventh day in honor of God's creation, is a symbol of dependence upon God, worshiping the Creator instead of ourselves, depending upon Him instead of ourselves. Therefore, Sabbath is something more than just keeping 24 hours, quotes, holy. Now, let me ask you this. On that basis, would it be possible to have a Saturday-keeping Sunday keeper? Couldn't you have a Saturday-keeping Sunday keeper? Someone who goes to church on Saturday but believes in the philosophy that Sunday represents, depending upon himself instead of depending upon God. Could you have a Sunday-keeping Sabbath keeper? Why, if a person hasn't understood yet, you could have a person who worships on Sunday, who is really a Sabbath keeper because he depends upon Jesus Christ instead of himself for his salvation, couldn't you? Of course, you could also have a Sunday-keeping Sunday keeper. And you could have a Sabbath-keeping Sabbath keeper. And that's the one I'd like to be. A Sabbath-keeping Sabbath keeper instead of a Saturday-keeping Sunday keeper. Well, I'll spare you any further on that. I'd like to invite you to work on that when you're looking at the ceiling tonight during your sleeping hours. Let's go on to the name or number. You know that the name or number of the beast, according to Revelation 13, verse 17, is definitely mentioned. And you know what we've done with it in historical and prophetic sense. 666, you know, that stands out pretty heavy. And someone came along and says, well, you can get 666 out of Ellen G. White. And that's true. But they forget to read the rest of the verse. It says it is the number of a man. And as we have looked at this, we realize that 666 in our understanding comes from the numerical value of the Latin title Vicarius Filii Dei, which merely means in place of God, vicar of the Son of God, in the place of God. This is what Babylon, this is what the name Babylon is all about. Do it yourself in place of God. Now let's go back to the Garden of Eden. And there you have a tree, and you have a serpent. And you have a woman that's wandering near the tree. And as she wanders near, the serpent begins to speak. And the serpent says, "Hi, Eve." And Eve is startled. And the serpent says, "You're wondering why I'm able to talk, aren't you?" And Eve says, "As a matter of fact, the thought had crossed my mind." And the serpent says, "You know why I'm able to talk? Because I have eaten of the fruit of this tree." Now, if I, a dumb creature, ate the fruit of this tree and am able to talk, what do you suppose would happen to you, an intelligent creature, if you ate the fruit of the tree? Why, you would become as God. And Eve thinks, not a bad idea. So she tries it. And that has been the devil's deception ever since. You shall be as gods. Now let me ask you, if I think that I'm going to be a Christian, or if I'm going to save myself eternally someday on the basis of my own works, Well, we say we don't go that far. No. No, the usual is, I believe I need God, but I'm going to do something to contribute to it. If I can go along day after day with no time for God, which is what 3/4 of the average church members are actually doing, if I never have any time to acknowledge to God that He is my Creator and that I'm only a creature and that I need Him, if I have no time for communion and fellowship with God, and I just expect Him to accept the will for the deed, if I'm living a life apart from God, in other words, and if I'm still hoping to be saved in heaven someday, who is my God? Is there any question about it? It goes deeper than theory. I become my own God. And this is the thing that the three angels are warning us about in Revelation 14. Ye shall be as gods? No. And this is true whether it has to do with salvation in heaven or salvation from my sins now. Which leads us into the last part of this fourfold symbology, the image to the beast, which is mentioned in Revelation 13, verse 15, and historically represents a power that was to follow the original beast power. And we understand it to be the United States, a power that would actually build a replica or become a facsimile of the beast power before it. Now, we have some very specific and plain comments concerning what the image to the beast is, what it's all about. And I'd like to have you notice these from Great Controversy, page 445 and 449. When the leading churches of the United States, uniting upon such points of doctrine as are held by them in common, shall influence the state to enforce their decrees and sustain their institutions, then Protestant America will have formed an image of the Roman hierarchy, and the infliction of civil penalties upon dissenters will inevitably result. But in the very act of enforcing a religious duty by secular power, the churches would themselves form an image to the beast. The image to the beast, then, is to enforce a religious duty by secular power. Do you get the message? The image to the beast is to make yourself do something by human power. And let's take it away from the great world power that's going to do that in the end and apply it individually. The image to the beast is to force yourself to obey while living a life apart from God, even though you acknowledge that God exists. We have always said that the image of the beast was a combination of a religio-political system. That's what the beast was originally. The image of the beast is God plus man. It is hoping in God plus man. The image to the beast is to force myself to do what's right through dependence upon my strength and my power instead of dependence upon God's strength and His power. That's what the image to the beast is all about. And the fantastic truth is that man's power plus God's power, or God's power plus man's power, equals no power. Anytime you get a combination of God's power and man's power, you have no power. Well, you say, where does cooperation in the human understanding come? Cooperation comes in giving up on our power and going to God for His power. That's where the cooperation has always been. And there will be people in the final end of this whole three angels message who will admit that we cannot save ourselves in heaven eternally. That we'll have to depend totally upon Jesus and the cross for that, who will still hold on like bulldogs to the idea that we can save ourselves in some way from our sinning or our failures. And they continue to hold on to this cooperation idea of trusting partly to God and partly to themselves for victory, for power, for strength, for obedience. That is the image to the beast, and it's blasphemy. I have tried in a number of ways to talk about this point and feel like a failure because of all the misunderstanding that sometimes develops. But please study it in relationship to the three angels, because the three angels' messages include both justification by faith and the righteousness of Christ in the life now. In the life now. And nobody understands the righteousness of Christ in the life now who hasn't come to the end of his own resources and given up on his strength and his power. Well, I'll spare you for the hard lines on the torment and the lake of fire and no rest. And bring that into the second service. You can listen to that on tape. But the main point is, in the end, that there is no rest. There is no rest. For the person who hopes to save himself in heaven, and there is no rest for the person who is a victim of the image of the beast and is trying to save himself in any way, or even part of the way, from sinning and from defeat. There is no rest. Instead, the great love of God still beckons us. As Jesus said, "Come unto me, come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest."